So the Anthropocene came out as a geological unit 10 years ago, somewhere in there, because post the Industrial Revolution, you can see in the rock layers, there's a stratigraphic boundary between industrialized human culture and pre-industrialized human culture because we've changed the landscape so much. Humans get in there and they just muck it all up. But, you know, there's a lot of, I guess, older generations of geologists are like, don't you mess with my time scale. There's no such thing. We're in the Holocene, darn it. And so you get a lot of arguing back and forth. But yes, the Anthropocene is a thing, and it is our current division of geologic time. Jeez. Never underestimate humankind. We are capable of anything, of the greatest, you know, inventions, the greatest ingenuity, and the most spectacular YouTube fails.
Long before modern man walked the Earth, our planet was home to a vast array of fascinating fauna, so bizarre they defy the limits of human imagination. Over the past century, Western Colorado has emerged as a region rich in paleontological treasure, and through the work of dedicated local paleontologists, continues to play a vital role in advancing our understanding of the prehistoric world. In part one of Going Paleo, I sit down with Julia McHugh, curator of paleontology for Museums of Western Colorado, who provides insight into the work of a paleontologist, Western Colorado's importance to this particular field of science, and new revelations from a study of so-called forgotten fragments, spearheaded right here in the high desert. Welcome to Season 3 of the official podcast of Crossing the Divide, a multimedia exploration of life in the Intermountain West. Crossing the Divide counters a media culture fixated on urbanism and elevates a region defined by open space, sweeping vistas, big skies, and natural wonder. I'm Gretchen Reist, guiding you over the divide and into the diverse terrain of the American West. Julia, welcome to Crossing the Divide.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Let's start out with your job. You are the curator of paleontology for Museums of Colorado. Tell us a little bit about what that job entails.
Sure. So as the paleontologist for the museum, I am in charge of all of the research. I'm basically in charge of all the entire department of paleontology at the museum. So that involves research, exhibits, working with federal agencies to secure collection permits. So when we go out and do our field work, I'm actually digging up dinosaurs. So I'm in charge of maintaining all of the behind the scenes for that, as well as running our very popular public dinosaur dig program where we let kids as young as 5 come out on real scientific expeditions with us and help us dig up the dinosaur bones. They have a wonderful time. It's great. I also teach down at the college. I am an instructor of geology at Colorado Mesa University, as well as being the curator of paleontology at the museums. And it's a lot of fun. You wear a lot of hats. You do a lot of different things. So every day is different. People always ask me, what is your typical day? Well, I will let you know when I have one. Because it can range everything from me being down in collections and cataloging and like our fossil material, kind of like a library of getting numbers on the specimens and getting them where they need to go, to taking measurements, working in the lab, working in exhibits, or spending an entire day at my computer trying to figure out how best to write a grant for anything from research to marketing.
Prior to becoming the curator for Museums of Western Colorado, curator of paleontology, were you just a paleontologist working in the field? Where did you come to us from?
So prior to coming here, I was a research assistant at Oklahoma State University's Center for Health Sciences. It's their medical school in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So my job there was to be the research assistant for 4 paleontologist faculty members. So I ran all of their labs while they were inundated with coursework. I also ran our volunteer program. I ran our common use prep lab. I actually helped design part of the prep lab. I was a research associate at the Sam Noble Oklahoma Museum of Natural History in Norman, Oklahoma. I worked on field work, I worked on research projects, and did a lot of grant writing there as well.
Are all paleontologists associated with a museum, or are there paleontologists who I guess you would call freelance that are writing their own grants and working out in the field, or how does that work?
There's a good variety of jobs for paleontologists. So a lot of them work at a university as a professor. You have a lot in the museum world. You get a lot in the consultant world where you have here in Colorado, if you have a pipeline going through, whether it's an oil or gas pipeline, there's certain remediation that has to happen. You have to watch out for Native American artifacts. You have to watch out for endangered species, endangered plants. You also have to watch out for fossils. And so a lot of paleontologists work as consultants with the oil and gas companies to catalog and log and make sure that all of the paleontological resources, all of the fossils that are in the way of the pipeline, get properly accounted for. We also see a lot of paleontology jobs emerging in the medical sciences field. So at a medical school where doctors are going to learn how to be doctors, you'll find a lot of paleontologists because paleontologists are being hired to teach the anatomy classes. So you'll find them there. You'll also find them at veterinary schools. So it's actually quite a good variety of different types of jobs for paleo now.
That is interesting because I think most of us would assume that paleontology is, well, it is a study of the past, but that is an interesting point as to how it relates even in today's world.
Yeah, and there's a lot of overlap for different animals. A lot of their anatomy is very similar. And you, especially in sort of the medical field, a lot of the medical doctors, they want to teach their specialty. They want to teach endocrinology or they want to teach neurology. They really dislike teaching that general gross anatomy course because it's a lot of work and it's a lot of, kind of the mundane stuff. And so paleontologists are more than happy to take those jobs and teach the anatomy courses. And then they'll teach courses in paleontology on the off semester and then do their field work in the summer.
Are paleontologists utilized at all in the study of something like global climate change?
Yes, quite a lot. So there's a lot that we can tell in the fossil record. There are a lot of good correlates to what is happening today, particularly in certain facets of the fossil record. So there was a huge spike in global temperatures between the boundaries of the Paleocene and the Eocene, and what we are able to piece together there is kind of giving us a window into what could happen today if you have a huge spike in CO2 levels and global temperatures. We see lots of changes in the plant fauna. We see lots of changes in the animal fauna. It might not necessarily be like a huge mass extinction event, but you're going to see a lot of turnover. You're going to see shifts in the ecosystems. You're going to see shifts in where rain is falling. So you're going to see climate shift in, average rainfall. So some areas that are kind of borderline with the desert are going to become full desert. The deserts are going to expand and the rainfalls are going to contract, which has a huge impact on our agriculture. I don't know about you, but I like to eat. I like to eat a lot. So being able to go into the past and see what has happened before to kind of give us a window as to what could happen in the future is going to impact our very basic function of staying alive by eating food.
I recently visited the fossils of the Grand Valley exhibit at Dinosaur Journey, which takes you through the history of various local finds and past curators of the museum. I wanted to ask if you are the first woman to hold the curator of paleontology position, because I noticed a lot of names come up and it struck me that in terms of curator of paleontology, you seem to be the first female name.
That is true. I am by happenstance to be the first female curator of paleontology at the Museums of Western Colorado. We have had female collections managers before. They've come in and out. But as far as holding the title of curator of paleontology, I am the first one. Now, the Museums of Western Colorado has only been around for a little bit more than 50 years, which means you have less than 10 curators. So it's not like we are one of the East Coast museums where you have dozens and dozens of curators and it's like a huge bar to break through. But still, it is significant. You tend to see a lot more female paleontologists in the field these days. You tend to see a lot of more females just in the museum world in general. But if you go to any paleontology conference, you'll see almost a 50-50 split in the students. in the graduate students and the undergraduate students of people who are interested in paleontology. And that looks great until you start looking around at, okay, well, who's got the jobs? Mm. And you'll notice that that 50-50 ratio starts to go down. Mm. And what happens is, and there have been a lot of studies trying to figure out, why aren't we keeping women in these science fields? And it's not just paleontology, it's engineering, it's math, it's all over the board. But as far as the undergraduate and the graduate level students, it tends to be more 50-50. But once you get into the workforce, that dwindles down. And one of the things that they've been looking at is the way the whole, especially at universities, the way the whole tenure structure is set up is very rigid and is not very lenient for some of the things that women have no control over. So if you are part of a married couple and one part of that married couple becomes pregnant, well, it's a lot easier for the man in the relationship to be able to go to work every day and meet all of their deadlines. But if you are the female and you are trying to get academic tenure, which is a very rigorous process, and maybe you have a high-risk pregnancy, you're far more susceptible to stress. Insomnia is very common in early career scientists. And so it becomes a biological catch-22 because you want to, you know, have your children, but sometimes it's physically very difficult to stay in those academic fields when you're also trying to, you know, just live your life. And we also see a lot in just more broadly in the science fields of women being encouraged to do more service projects, so sitting on more committees, doing a lot more of the behind-the-scenes stuff, while male academics are encouraged to do more research.
Hmm.
And so there is this implicit bias in the system of pushing women towards keeping the house in order and pushing men towards the research. And so you see a lot of people getting frustrated with that and kind of pursuing other options or dropping out of the field. And what we need to do is we need to look at those implicit biases and make sure that everybody is being encouraged to do all of the work, that the male colleagues are doing their fair share of the committee service, and everybody is being encouraged to do more of the research, more of the primary research.
So we've looked at ratios of men to women. Are we getting minorities interested in fields of science like paleontology?
We are. And one of the minorities that I've had the wonderful opportunity to work with are some of our Native American colleagues. Because a lot of them just now are starting to get more engaged in the paleontology field. It had been in the past where you would see the minority demographic being focused specifically on Asian Americans and African Americans, but now you're starting to see it broaden out to looking at endemic populations as well as maybe Pacific Islanders, of trying to encourage them to go into these fields and take it back to their own communities and really build the STEM fields where they come from. And you know, they're part of the United States. And so if we can get them lifting up the scientific rigor, we can lift it up all over the United States. And there are even some kind of more extreme examples. With the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, they actually have their own museum and their own paleontological program through the tribe, which is great. It's super wonderful. You also have programs like in Oklahoma, a program called the Native Explorers Program, which is encouraging kids to go on these expeditions, you know, kind of far away, getting them, you know, to push their limits of getting farther from home. We know we all struggle with that in college, but some people struggle a little more than others. And just really getting them to, you know, explore the natural world and explore STEM fields as a career.
As a paleontologist, what personal qualities or characteristics do you think makes somebody an ideal candidate for working in that field? I would have to imagine at least patience is one, because you're not always getting the big find.
Right. And, patience is something you can't really, you know, read a book about and learn. You just have to sort of accrue it through life. Patience is one. I always tell people that, you know, these fossils have been buried for 150 million years. They can wait another day. It'll be okay. And I am also, you know, very guilty of being impatient and wanting to get things done right away. So patience is definitely one. You also want to look for somebody who has the ability to be both very creative and thinking outside the box, as well as being very analytical of following all the steps and checking all the boxes and making sure everything is kind of right where it needs to be. And I say that because, you know, paleontology is a fairly small field. There's not a whole lot of infrastructure as far as, you know, tools and materials that are specifically dedicated to paleontology. So we have to end up co-opting a lot of our basic tools that we use to work with from other fields, from, you know, construction industries to, you know, chemistry and biology and, you know, just all around the automotive industry, just figuring out how to jerry-rig a situation in order to ensure, number one, the safety of all of your crew, the safety of the fossils that you're digging out and getting them back to the museum. And that can sometimes be very difficult. So you need to be able to be both super analytical and also remember that one crazy hydraulic lift cart that you once saw on a catalog page, and how can that work in the paleo lab?
So is that an industry that's waiting to be born?
I think at this point, the industry is still so small that basic supply and demand, you're not going to have enough demand to ensure a steady supply, and the prices will go way up. So at this point, it's still very much thinking outside the box. I'll give you an example. When I was in Oklahoma, we were wanting to do a process called acid digestion. And we had this rind of calcium carbonate over the fossils. And we wanted to get that off without having to mechanically like chisel it off. So we coated the exposed bone in a protective plastic. And then we submerged them in fairly weak acetic acid. So about the double the strength of vinegar. So not terribly, terribly acidic, but it's enough that you need special containers in order to hold the acid, especially when you're diluting the more potent acids down to the level that you want. And, you know, you can go through companies like Fisher Scientific, which cater to the medical industry, and pay $200 for a tub to put your acid in, or you can realize that that tub is made out of a material called high-density polyethylene, or HDPE for short. You look on the bottom of those painter buckets that they have at Home Depot, they're made out of the exact same stuff. So you can pay $5 at Home Depot and have the exact right material that you need in order to run your experiment. So that's where the thinking out of the box comes in.
If you could, take us through the educational process required to work in this field.
So a lot of it there's a lot to learn. It's a fairly complicated science because it requires you to know a little bit about a bunch of different sciences in order to do paleontology. So if you're in college, you're going to want to take a lot of biology classes and geology classes, throw in a good spattering of statistics, a little bit of chemistry, a little bit of physics. And you can either major in geology or you major in biology. Both, depending on which school you're in, will give you a good foundation. Typically, paleontologists will have a master's degree, which is the next degree after your undergraduate degree. That can take anywhere from 2 to 3 or 4 years to complete. And then if you want specific jobs in paleontology, specific jobs will require what we call the union card, that good old PhD, because there are requirements in the system that require you to have that PhD in order to have those jobs. So a academic professor, they're going to want you to have a PhD. A museum curator, especially if you're in my situation where you're taking care of specimens that are owned by the federal government, they want a PhD involved in that. So not every job requires a PhD, but a lot of them do. So you'll need to figure out if you want those jobs, or if you maybe decide you would like to be a preparator. And preparators are great. They typically have a master's degree, so they're not all the way into PhD land. And they run the labs, the prep labs. And so they're the ones who are in charge of cleaning the bones, of prioritizing projects, and figuring out new methods for cleaning the bones. Collections managers are also typically master's degree holders. And so they're the ones who maintain the collections. I had somebody years ago describe collections managers to me as that person who goes around and cleans up after the curator. Which has always stuck in my brain, because knowing the curators as I do, some people really need that in their life. but as far as the consultant world is a fairly a small world, and so your biggest issue there is going to be competition for the jobs. And typically the competition will drive up how many degrees you need to have in order to get to the top of the pile. And so you see a lot of people with master's degrees. You'll even see a few PhDs in there in the consultant world. So if you want to be a educator, somebody who is not necessarily doing the hardcore research, but translating that research from science ease into the general public's ears. And that's what our education curator, Stephanie Lukowski, that's her job. And so her terminal degree is a master's degree. And so she gets to work with the kids. She gets to work with the families and still work with the fossils, but in a very hands-on, organic type of way. So it really depends on where you want to go in paleontology as to what type of degree, what type of education you're going to need. Now, if this person who wants to be a paleontologist is still a few years away from going to college, there are still things that they can do. There are wonderful books out there that they can get their hands on and read. One of the first books on paleontology I ever read, it's out of print now, but if you can find a copy, I highly recommend it. It was called The Great Dinosaur Hunters and Their Discoveries, and it was all the historic dinosaur discoveries from the 1800s up into the early 1900s, and they had all the historic photographs and everything in there. It was a great book. Other great books include My Beloved Brontosaurus by Brian Switek. The Dinosaur Heresies was really great when I was a kid for me, because it kept poking holes in all the things that we would take for granted in assessing questions about the natural world. Discovering Dinosaurs, The Complete Dinosaur is a great book. So get your hands on some of these books. Reach out to some of the Facebook groups for paleontology, and they will give you so many more great books to read. And then start watching all the documentaries that are available. And they will often perk your interest in a particular group of fossils or a particular type of paleontological study, and then you can go further in from there.
All right, you brought up Brontosaurus, so I have to ask this question. I wasn't going to. The little bit of information I got about paleontology, I believe it was in fourth grade, and the Brontosaurus was the one that was brought up. And I've always remembered it. It's probably the only dinosaur that I could ever remember the name of.
It's a great name. Thunder Lizard. It's a wonderful name.
And then a couple of years ago, I thought I had read that the Brontosaurus was no more, that they didn't think it existed, but now it's back again?
So Brontosaurus is kind of an interesting critter, and it has a local tie-in. So here in the Grand Valley, the two earliest expeditions to recover fossils were done by Elmer Riggs from the Columbian Field Museum, which is now the Field Museum of Natural History. In 1900, he discovered a Camarasaurus skeleton and the very first Brachiosaurus ever found. He came back in 1901 and dug up another skeleton in Fruta, what's now known as Dinosaur Hill. Now, that dinosaur he dug out of the ground, he later would say was the most significant find of his career. And what he did with that skeleton was he started examining it and comparing it to other sauropod dinosaurs, so these long neck, long tail dinosaurs. By 1901, 1902, 1903, the early 1900s, we'd had a lot of them excavated, so there was a lot of material for him to compare to. Now, there was another animal that had been dug up from Wyoming at a place called Como Bluff, and that was the animal known as Brontosaurus. And so he was looking at his dinosaur from Dinosaur Hill, which was Apatosaurus, and he noticed that all of the parts of the skeleton that were the criteria for determining that they were different animals all changed as these dinosaurs got older. They're all parts of the skeleton that change as you grow. And of course, one of the skeletons he was looking at was a juvenile or a subadult. It wasn't fully grown. And the other one was the adult. And so in 1903, Elmer Riggs published a paper saying that these two animals are the same animal. They're just at different growth stages. Now, in science, whatever name is published first has priority. And so Brontosaurus became the junior synonym for Apatosaurus. But that was back in 1903. Now, I'm pretty sure you were not in fourth grade in 1903.
No.
You're a little too young for that. So what happened was Brontosaurus had such a pop culture following. It was such a great name. It was such a great image that it remained in jargon in pop culture until pretty much the 80s and early 90s when finally paleontologists had enough. I'm like, okay, stop putting it in your kids' books. It's not a thing, even though it's a great name. We love the name, but it's not a thing. Please stop. Well, a couple years ago, a scientific study came out by Emanuel Schoft and a few co-authors. And what they did was they were looking at the evolutionary history of these types of dinosaurs. And they found that the original Brontosaurus skeleton from Wyoming was significantly different than the others. But the trick is it different enough to be a new genus? And that's where the subjective part of this comes in, because we can quantify how similar or how different they are based on homologous characters, characters that are parts of the skeleton that are the same because they were inherited from a common ancestor. But where you draw the line between when one species stops and another species begins, that is still kind of subjective. So the debate has risen back up as to whether or not Brontosaurus is real, or is it just a really odd species of Apatosaurus?
I'm glad to get clarification on
awesome.
That.
Well, you know, if you ask kids to name a dinosaur, they will either name a T-Rex, because that's the most common name that kids know, or they will recognize a silhouette outline. And the silhouette outline they always recognize is the Apatosaur Brontosaurus outline, because it is the most iconic kind of shape of a dinosaur, whereas T-Rex is kind of one of the more iconic names.
In my research for this podcast, I learned that there are some paleontologists who don't study dinosaurs. Had no idea. And that we do specialize, or you do specialize as paleontologists. Your specialty is amphibians, so I wanted to know what it is about amphibians in particular that piqued your interest.
Well, you know, a lot of different scientists study a lot of different groups. Dinosaurs are certainly the most famous extinct group of organisms. But I can't turn down a good underdog. I always root for the underdog. I always bet on the long shot at the Kentucky Derby. But I got into amphibians, not necessarily because I was, you know, gung-ho, yeah, amphibians, but I was trying to figure out a particular question. And this was during my PhD research, and I was trying to figure out why certain animals live during a mass extinction, why some survive as opposed to why all the others tend to die out. So what is it about these groups that survive that make them prone to survive? Because maybe if we figure that out, we could figure out how to save some endangered species today. I mean, that would be pretty cool if there was a common thread on why you survive. And so I was looking at the mother of all mass extinctions, the largest biological catastrophe in Earth's history, the Permo-Triassic mass extinction, which happened about 252 million years ago. And now, if you go back to that point in the geologic record, there are two groups of animals with an internal skeleton, the vertebrate animals, that are most commonly preserved as fossils. One are our ancestors, the synapsids, which would later give rise to mammals. And then the second most abundant group of fossils are amphibians. Well, there were a ton of people researching the synapsids and virtually nobody looking at the amphibians. So I thought, here's a big group of fossils that are readily available at the time period I want to study, and they survive. And there's not a whole lot of competition to look at them. So let's look into there. And the more I studied this group of amphibians, they're called the temnospondyls, the more fascinated I got about how just wonderfully weird they are. You get a huge variety, huge diversity of sizes and shapes of these guys from animals that would fit in your hand and would have the external fluffy gills like a Mexican axolotl, to things that were 20 feet long with giant fangs all over the roof of their mouth that could swallow you whole. Mm. So the stuff of nightmares all the way down to the itty bitty cute guys. And, you know, I just started working with them and starting to figure out their biology and their evolutionary history and how they grow, some basic fundamental questions about their existence. And it turns out amphibians are great to figure out what's going on in the ecosystem because they have a freshwater larval stage. So if you mess with their ecosystem at all, they're really sensitive to that. We know that today with modern frogs and salamanders. Like, if you mess with the chemistry of a salamander's breeding pond, you're going to get a bunch of dead salamanders. They really don't tolerate changes in chemistry or UV light or anything really well. But these guys were surviving the worst conditions in Earth's history. So it was kind of a conundrum. And the more I looked into them, the more I realized that, boy, they have the ability to really change with their environment. They're what we call very plastic. They can just, this is different. I'm just going to change over and do this thing. And that ability to be very adaptable to changes is probably what helped them survive. And it allowed them to kind of behave sort of like pioneer species after a wildfire. So you get a lot of them coming in and filling all the open niche space, and then they die off after a few hundred thousand or a couple million years. And then you have a whole bunch more come in, and that just repeats over and over again until you get finally the full ecosystem rebounding from the huge mass extinction in the middle part of the Triassic period.
How do amphibians stack up in terms of survivability against cockroaches?
Cockroaches are definitely going to win. Cockroaches are, it goes tardigrades, cockroaches, and then somewhere further down are amphibians.
I was thinking that as you were saying that. Well, if you really wanted to study survivability,
yeah,
you might want to focus on those cockroaches.
Cockroaches,
unfortunately.
Yeah, cockroaches are really, really great at surviving. And, you know, a lot of bacteria are super resistant and really able to survive. But, you know, they're pretty far away from a lot of, like, the polar bears and the vertebrate animals that we're interested in today, elephants and that sort of thing. So kind of want to get closer to that part of the family tree. And amphibians are still pretty far away, but they're awful interesting. And we have a lot of endangered amphibian species today, too. So looking into them will help their living relatives.
While I have you here today, I did want to touch upon this issue of forgotten fragments that I learned about when I went to the Fossils of the Grand Valley exhibit.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about what that is and what kind of project you're spearheading on that.
So we received a grant from the David B. Jones Foundation in 2018 to start looking at some of the fossils that we typically did not collect. So one of the things that I'm interested in is not only what species are alive or existed in previous geologic time periods, but how those species interacted with each other. And interaction between living animals doesn't always fossilize very well. So out at our Myget Moore Quarry out in Rabbit Valley, which the museum has been working for over 30 years, we have a lot of really wonderful fossils that have come out of there. We also have a lot of what we call nuggets. So these are broken bits of previously larger bones. They're typically, you cannot identify what bone they're from. You cannot identify what animal they're from. And so these have been kind of overlooked. And so starting in about 2016, I wanted to start looking at them a little bit more closely. So we got a Sharpie. We got a couple of 5-gallon buckets, and we wrote on those buckets, nugget buckets. And so we just started all the nuggets that we were finding, we started just putting in those buckets. And as we started looking through them, we started to see a lot of the similar things that we were seeing on some of the larger bones. That the surface of the bone wasn't pristine and pure, it was kind of marked up. And it was marked up from, just abrasion of rocks sliding across the surface, gouging grooves. We found where insects had been nibbling on the bones and crunching down into the surface of the bone. Think about that. So if you are out hiking and you see a rotting carcass, typically maggots are going to be coming out of the fleshy bits. Think of how far along that carcass has to be before the maggots are starting to go after the bone material. That takes a while. Hmm. And so looking at the insect trace damage is giving us an idea of how long dinosaur bones were on the surface before they got buried. We also see some etching from where plant roots are starting to dig into the dinosaur bones, which tells you some interesting stuff about soil development.
Were they weeds?
Probably.
Weeds are amazing.
They're crazy. And then we're also seeing a lot of bite marks. And the top predators in the Jurassic period, especially in the types of sediments that we are working on, would have been either other dinosaurs, meat-eating dinosaurs, or you have had fairly like good-sized crocodile relatives, so crocodiliforms. Now, crocodiliforms have very different teeth than theropod dinosaurs, and so their teeth leave a very distinctive set of marks, and the marks we are finding are consistent with dinosaur tooth marks. And so right now we're going through and tabulating all of our data. So throughout all of last year, we went through the thousands of bones that are in the museum collections that we've already collected, looking over every single surface of every bone with a flashlight to see if we can find any teeny tiny little marks on the bones, recording where those marks are, what kind of marks they are, taking calipers and measuring all of the marks. Some of the better examples, we were 3D scanning to get kind of a more depth of measurement. So we have we can make 3D models of them. And we had a couple of great interns from CMU who are helping us out, Anya and Miriam. And we went to a conference last year and gave a preliminary report of our findings. We've been working very closely with the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, Dr. Stephanie Drumheller there. She and I have known each other for years, and she works in mostly on crocodile bite marks, but she's also been working on some dinosaur stuff. So I had this great data set. She had a lot of knowledge about what can happen to bones. So we teamed up to do this project. And now we're at the point where we've gone through almost 2,200 fossils, counting them, calculating, measuring, and we're getting ready to write some of this up for publication. And we've been finding some pretty interesting things. A lot of the stuff you would expect that on the nice juicy rib bones of a apatosaurus, yeah, you'd find some bite marks there because that's where the good meat is. Like on the arms and legs, you would find some bite marks. That's where the good meat is. But we're also finding bite marks on some of the bad parts of the skeleton. I don't know if you've ever been to a steakhouse, but you usually don't go and say, hey, I'd like a string of vertebrae, please. There is virtually no good meat on those vertebrae. It's all ligaments and sinew, but we're finding bite marks and lots of insect traces on there. And these animals were on the surface for at least 6 months before they were getting buried, and just all sorts of nastiness happening to them. But it's sort of grossology meets dinosaurs, so it's gross, but it's also kind of cool because it's dinosaurs. So it's been a really fun project. It's created a huge data set for us to work with, and we're able to really kind of figure out what is happening on the surface of the Earth in the Jurassic period between these animals dying at this watering hole and getting buried and becoming fossils. Yes, we're finding insect traces, but we're also finding 3 to 4 different types of insect traces. So there was a whole ecosystem of carrion insects that were making marks on the skeletons of dinosaur bones. So it's not just all chucked up to one general insect, but we're actually able to piece out different types of marks, and that does not necessarily correspond to species, but it does correspond to different types of feeding behavior. And so we're able to parse that out. We're able to parse out different sizes of predators that were biting into the bone. So we have some smallish animals that probably were juveniles, and then we have some bigger individuals. and we have some medium-sized individuals. And what bones they were eating, how frequently they were eating different parts of the skeleton, and what prey species they were eating and what non-prey species they were eating. We actually have a lot of bite marks on theropod material. So this was, at certain times of the year, probably a very stressed ecosystem where you have animals just eating whatever is at the surface, even if it was formerly alive and of your kind. It doesn't matter. There's nothing else to eat, so they're going to eat that too.
And you're the only team really looking at these fragments?
There have been other teams who have looked at other sites before, but this is the first really large-scale examination of a whole site like this. Usually it's been cherry-picking here and there what's already in museum collections, but we're going back and looking at the stuff that would not necessarily make it into the museum collections and seeing how that is affecting the data set. So we can take those, because we've coded them, we can take them out of the data set and run it with just the museum quality pretty specimens and then with the ugly fossils. And it turns out that they change the accuracy and the precision of your results if you include all of those ugly fossils. And those ugly fossils have then become our little ambassadors of teaching other people in the field of, hey, you got an extra $5, don't discard your data, and really kind of helping to educate other people who do field work on how to maximize their data collection, as well as teaching our students from CMU how to do research. And they are involved in primary research, and they will be co-authors on those papers. And they got to go to a scientific conference and present their research. So giving them real-world research experience, as well as training our volunteers on what to look for when they're out helping us dig up dinosaur bones. And even just educating the public with including these in exhibits and giving them proper interpretation.
So what you're working on could potentially be a very big contribution to the entire field of paleontology.
Yeah, it could. We're kind of coming down on the finishing up of this part of the research. What we're looking forward to next is expanding this to other sites. So our data set will tell us what was happening at the Mygatmore Quarry. Well, is that the same or different from what was happening up at Dinosaur National Monument? How does that compare to what was happening at the Cleveland Lloyd Dinosaur Quarry? So we want to start looking at these other quarries and seeing, is Mygatmore just really weird and a really gross place, or was that normal for the Jurassic period? And then after that, the next step after that would be, okay, how does that compare to Cretaceous dinosaur sites? And then starting to branch out there. So this could really cascade into decades of research of really trying to figure out what was going on as these fossil sites were forming.
Can you speak to what level of contribution the work in this region has been and will be for the entire field of paleontology? How does this region rank with others?
You know, we are in one of the best places in North America to look at dinosaur paleontology. So this area has contributed not only new species, but has really provided a huge window into the extinct world. To give you some examples, near the area of Fruta is one of the only, it's maybe fewer than six fossil sites in all of North America that preserves in abundance the tiny animals that lived alongside the dinosaurs. So primitive snakes that still had legs, early mammals, lizard relatives. So all of these tiny creatures that made up the bulk of the ecosystem, because if you look around today, most of the ecosystem is small critters. It's squirrels, it's chipmunks, it's bugs, it's plants. It's not the big megafauna like you and me and elephants and giraffes that are running around. So this area has really helped to fill that in. This area also has about four fossil sites in the entire Morrison Formation that produces eggshell. I take that back. It's less than 10. There are fewer than 10 sites in the Morrison Formation that produce eggshell. Well, the site near Fruta is the only site in the entire Morrison Formation. And this is a geological formation, a rock unit that extends through 9 states and up into Canada. This is a big rock unit. It's the only place where you find both the egg layer and the eggs. We have found some of the rarest of dinosaurs, like Fruitadens. Fruitadens belongs to a very rare group of plant-eating dinosaurs called the Heterodontosaurids. It's one of the last known occurrences of Heterodontosaurids, and it's one of the most northern occurrences of that group. So it's very special. Just over the state line, near Moab, we have the museum has a fossil that has been incorporated into our collections of the only vertebrate animal from the Entrada sandstone. So the Entrada sandstone is this beautiful sandstone unit that makes up all of the arches at Arches National Park. It's a gorgeous unit. Not many fossils in it, but the one fossil that has been found of a vertebrate animal, it's a little crocodile. So it's a crocodile that's maybe a foot long that lived in sand dunes. Think of that, a little 1 foot long, tiny toed crocodile that's running around the sand dunes of the Jurassic period, going from oasis to oasis, hunting bugs or whatever else it could catch. And we managed to find it and bring it into the museum. This area has produced the first ankylosaur ever found in the Jurassic period. It is the southernmost occurrence of one of the nightmarest of nightmare fish, Xiphactinus, which is this huge fish. In outline, it sort of looks like a lot of the bony fish that you would go fishing for today, except it's about 18 feet long and has giant teeth and would eat your face. So there is a lot of very important discoveries that have happened here in the Grand Valley, which is one of the reasons why we put together that temporary summer exhibit this year of fantastic fossils of the Grand Valley, just to remind people of why this area is so amazing. There's so much there's so many discoveries that have been made within since the 1970s in this area, all the way back to 1900, and then we're still doing brand new research today. We're still making new discoveries that might not necessarily give you the biggest, baddest dinosaur that ever lived, but it's going to shape how paleontology is done in the future. So this area is a really great place to learn paleontology, to do paleontology, and to just enjoy it. We are one of the four corners of the Dinosaur Diamond National Scenic Byway. So if you liked dinosaurs, hop on that. It'll take you up to Vernal, down to Price and Moab, and back to Fruita. And you'll see just how wonderfully preserved the fossils are in our region and some of the great science that's been done on them.
Julia, thank you so much for being here. I think that's a great place for us to stop, is to look at how big and vital a role the work being done here plays in the entire field. I think that most of us walking around every day probably don't have a full appreciation of how important this work is. So thank you for being here. Thank you for the wonderful work that you do. And we can't wait to find out what major find you come out with next.
Oh, thank you. I'm more than happy to come back anytime you'll have me.
That ends another edition of Crossing the Divide. Thanks for tuning in. Access our full lineup of conversations with Western Voices by searching Crossing the Divide on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and Spotify. Hit subscribe to stay plugged in to each new episode. Follow Crossing the Divide on Facebook and Instagram to keep up on podcast releases and access exclusive video and photography. Support for Crossing the Divide's official podcast comes from Rocky Mountain PBS, Mesa County Libraries, and the Daily Sentinel. Crossing the Divide, a voice for the Intermountain West.